Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights.
Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Viktor Orban in Hungary, or Sebastian Kurz in Austria. Countries around the world are still or once again being governed by right-wing conservative to right-wing populist politicians. But right-wing populist views and anti-gender ideologies can also be found in all of our surroundings, among friends, at work, or in the family. And that's why in today's episode we are talking about the anti-gender discourse. Because this right-wing populist influence is still so big on women's and gender rights, today is not the first episode where we talk about this topic. I've already talked about it with Professor Andrea Pette and Professor Ina Kerner as well. So I'm very happy to host another episode of Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights. My name is Katharina Usling, and today I welcome Professor Birgit Sauer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Vienna, and Professor Julia Roth, Professor for American Studies with a focus on Gender Studies and Inter-American Studies here at Bielefeld University. As in every episode, I would like to start with a short introduction round. Birgit Sauer, what is your research focus, especially at the ZIF Group?
Well, my research focus is exactly, as you said a bit in the introduction, the right-wing populist mobilization against the concept of gender. So it's a specific part of contestations and of women's and gender rights, namely the mobilization of a conglomerate of actors. And within this conglomerate, right-wing populist parties, right-wing extremist organizations play an important role. So, and this is my main focus.
Thank you. Julia Roth, you were already a guest in the first episode and presented the work of the research group because you lead it together with Dr. Alexandra Scheele and Professor Heidemarie Winkel. For all of you who don't remember the first episode or are new to this podcast, what is your research topic and your focus in the research group?
Yes, hello. My research focus is actually closely connected to what Birgit already sort of mentioned. I'm also interested in the ways in which currently what we call the right-wing or right-wing populist complex, in order to include different actors and dimensions and phenomena within this trend you mentioned of increasing right-wing extremist conservative to populist, not only governments and politicians, but discourses, how gender is attacked by or within this complex, and also gender as a concept, but also gender and equality and gender rights. And I'm also particularly interested in the function that gender plays in there. So to look at how gender and sex or sexuality topics on those two are utilized or fulfill a particular function in that discourse. And that's basically what I look at.
So let's jump right into the topic. And at the beginning, I want to talk a bit about the current situation worldwide. So in Germany, in Europe, but all over the world. And maybe to you, Julia, the question, because you focus on USA and the Americas. What is the current situation?
I mean, of course, the Americas is a huge context. So yeah. I really want to emphasize that I cannot speak of all places and contexts or countries. But if we are interested in this increasing right-wing trend that I consider as part of a struggle over hegemony that we currently observe, so we see that there, similar to some contexts in Europe, something that Gabi Hadidze and I call an obsession with gender has moved center stage. So, and this is, I think, something we see in particular, for example, in Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro launches campaigns against sex education programs at school. He did so already before he became president, as one example. In the US, we also see that. And also, for example, in Colombia, we have one fellow from there also, where evangelical actors influence the government in the peace process to move all references to gender equality or the concept of gender from the referendum, from the text that they were voting on in 2016. And these are some of the phenomena we see. And also in other places, like a new debate on abortion rights, for example, in Argentina, in Mexico, a continuous extreme violence against women that also feminist movements oppose.
Yeah, and Birgit, to you the question as well. What would you say is the current situation, maybe in Europe or in Austria and Germany?
Yeah, well, I think that we can witness across Europe the emergence or the growth of right-wing populist parties. And Austria, as I always say, somehow won the race to the anti-gender and racist bottom across Europe when Jörg Haider took over the party in the late 1980s. So the Austrian FPÖ was rather successful in elections, and they were three times members of the Austrian government. So they were rather successful. But nevertheless, the French Front National, now Rassemblement National, is also rather successful. And we can see in Poland, the PiS government, and in Hungary, the Orbán government, are also right-wing populist parties, and they also use this anti-gender mobilization to create overall their, what they call, illiberal democracy. And this is a phenomenon which troubles me now since 10 years. Why do these right-wing parties across Europe, why do they use and fight against this concept of gender? And be it gender studies, and I think Andrea Petö might have talked about the closure of gender studies in Hungary, or be it the concept of gender mainstreaming, which has been launched by the European Union, for instance, or be it diversity education at schools and sexuality education at schools. So these are some of the main topics, all related to what these right-wing actors assume to be something that has to do with gender. And we also see it in the Nordic countries, well, as the Sweden Democrats or the Dansk Folkeparti, all right-wing parties that jump on this notion of gender. Of course, we can say, well, there are differences in the different countries. So while, for instance, in Austria or in Germany, the AfD opposed gender equality measures, meaning gender mainstreaming, this is, for instance, not the case in the Nordic countries, because there it belongs to their culture that women are equal to men. But there they use gender more in a welfare chauvinist way to exclude migrants. And this is what we can see, I think, across the continent in Europe, that we see that right-wing actors use gender for also other issues. Of course, they use this concept of gender to show that gender equality is not necessary or leads into a threat to the family, to the nation, but they also use it to mobilize against migrants, for instance. Whereas we can also see that in Russia, there is a mobilization against the issue of gender. And there it's also used to mobilize against gender equality in the family, for instance. And it's also the case in Turkey. Erdogan also mobilizes against gender. And now we see this with leaving the Istanbul Convention. So all across Europe, we can see this anti-gender mobilization with different aims, also partly different actors. But it seems to be a pan-European movement.
So you said, why is that? And maybe to discuss on that a bit, what forms of argumentation can you find in these countries, especially by the politicians, which are used against women and gender rights?
I think there is a set of arguments, but one first observation or disclaimer, I think that many of the right-wing actors have learned their lesson to a certain extent, so that outright anti, like I would say, misogynist, sexist discourse, at least in public, when we think of Donald Trump, it is complex, But such an outright sexist discourse is no longer what we face, but it has become more complex. So I think the idea that right-wing parties are only men's parties and it's just bringing women back to the kitchen, of course, we find that in part, but that's not enough. What we do see are certain paradoxes, and I will try to name a couple, or shifts and transformations, for example, from focusing on women's and gender equality to the family and so on and so forth. So one line of argument goes, and that's one we find predominantly in the West, partly in the US, for example, that women's and gender rights have already been achieved. Mm-hmm. So that our societies, in quotation marks, are already emancipated, and therefore we don't need all that. So feminists are sort of trying to divide society. And often, as Birgit mentioned, this serves the function to sort of argue against immigrants and others from the outside who are then depicted as homophobic, sexist, treating their women badly, possible sexual perpetrators, for example, and so on. So in a study by the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung for Europe, they put it in a nutshell very nicely. They're often arguing pro-women or for women, but against feminists.
Yeah.
So women are okay and they can be included as long as they are not feminists. Another line of argumentation that we find, for example, in East European contexts is that gender is seen as an import from the West or an imperial import. Partly in Poland, for example, rather with religious arguments, but partly also saying that from a post-socialist perspective, in our societies, we did have full employment and state-provided childcare. So we don't need all this gender studies stuff from there. And the third line would be often in combination with religious actors, and that's one we find particularly in Latin America, of the places I look at, for example, in Brazil, that gender ideology, and that's a term the Pope invented, or the Vatican, mm-hmm. already decades ago, is harmful for children, as in sex education, for the family. It questions conservative and religious values of a society. They question order per se by putting into question binary concepts and the natural roles of men and women, and also thereby threaten the nation and the reproduction of the nation. So I have called this a reverse anti-colonialism also, because in a way the Pope has said gender ideology is an ideological colonization. So he has learned his lesson from liberation theology also. Now gender studies representatives and feminists are the sort of the colonizers. So reversing this, sort of depicting Catholics as victims of that discourse. And the last one is a mobilization of social inequalities and fears that we, and in the US, for instance, Ali Hochschild has elaborated on that sort of affirmative action and promoting women's rights and quota for women is sort of privileging an undeserved minority, whereas the ones who are standing in line and would deserve more of that, of welfare, of recognition, of taking part, are sort of disadvantaged through these politics. And I think that's one. And there we come to the point also of the precarization in the current neoliberal context.
So you both mentioned that it's getting, that this discourse is more complex. And this is something I already talked about with Ina Kenner as well, about the fact how anti-feminism or anti-gender ideology goes together with anti-Muslim racism or racism as well. Birgit, would you say that this is one of the biggest problems, that it's so complex?
Yeah, I would say that these mobilizations are on the one hand complex. On the other hand, they are rather ambivalent. So they are not consistent. And you could say, well, this is also a sort of strategy, just not to be pinned down to one argument or to one ideology. And so the right-wing populists, they use their mobilization against gender in a rather, you could say, flexible way. And so it's adaptable to rather different societal constellations, and it's able to resignify a lot of societal problems. And I think what Julia already said is that you can resignify social inequality through the notion of gender. So on the one hand, you could say, well, it's because women want to enter the labor market. That's why, for instance, wages are going down, for instance, yeah, which is, of course, not true, because it's the international economy which dumps, for instance, wages. But you can use this gender signifier for a lot of argumentation. So, and therefore the complexity or the ambivalence fits right well the, you could say, non-ideological agenda of the right-wing populists, because they do not have a full-fledged ideology. They just aim to seize power. So this would be my argument. And they use this anti-gender mobilization to seize power. And this is what Julia, she already mentioned. This is the struggle for hegemony. They learned their lessons and they know that they have to somehow get into the heads, but also the hearts of people. And they do this by creating a threat and then inventing themselves as the saviors. But they also do it in saying, well, look, you all know what gender means. We all have gender. We all are women or men. And only these two genders exist, of course, in the right-wing populist narrations. And do you really want that this binary gender order collapses? Because if it collapses, then everything, the whole social order will collapse. So it's this threat that they use to somehow convince people that something is wrong in our societies. And, well, I would agree a lot is wrong in our societies, because over the last 30 years, the neoliberal restructuring of economies and of societies left to greater social inequality, for instance. And as you said, the anti-Muslim mobilization was leading to more racism within countries across Europe. So, and the right wingers, they try to profit from these feelings and moods in society, and they even mobilize these threatening narrations that exist. So, and they also use gender to do so, to promote their anti-migration agenda. And therefore, they are somehow successful, politically successful. And I think they use, so usually you say, well, right-wing populists, they do not have an ideology, but they have an antagonistic strategy. And antagonism means they create the people, the we, the in-group, against the elite. And they also use gender to create this antagonism, saying, well, the elite, these are these crazy feminist bureaucrats in Brussels who impose gender mainstreaming on the nation states, or the crazy feminists at universities who invent this idea of gender. Nobody can translate it into Germany. Nobody understands, or they want to that everybody changes their bodily gender and so on. And the other part of the antagonism is that they create the other, and the other could be different groups of people. It could be feminists, but mainly it's migrants. And there they use, interestingly, the argument that migrants are, especially Muslim migrants, are patriarchal, aggressive, sexist, while the own country, be it Germany, be it Austria or France, is already gender equal. There is no violence against women. So, and this is used to stigmatize migrants.
So you talked about that this argument, which is often used, and we all know it, that gender equality has been there already since ever. And wouldn't you say that this is a kind of instrumentalization of feminism by right-wing groups?
Absolutely. And I would also say that this is part of many of these actors' strategies. I mean, I'm not sure whether they say gender equality has been there forever, but that's a very central strategy. And I think it's related to this strategy of othering Birgit mentioned, because in a debate we had a day ago, emphasized that it serves the creation of Occidentalism in the sense of an Occidental self that's superior, emancipated. In gender studies terms, it is in the possession of a superior gender and sexual regime, and thereby sort of construct an orientalized, inferior, less emancipated other. So what we know from colonialism, it was earlier more civilized, and now this shifts or is occupied by the argument of women's and gender rights being an argument against immigration, again, a pro-racist argument. We have seen this in campaigns by the AfD, for example. Yeah. Our women remain free, and there was the whole poster campaign. But interestingly, it's not a pattern that's restricted to European concepts. For example, Donald Trump, when he wanted to build his wall, one of his arguments was it serves to keep the Mexican rapists out. So non-Muslim, but it's the other immigrant, mostly non-white, perpetrators of the national women. And he definitely doesn't mean African-American women here, but rather white or autochthonous, in quotation marks, women. And I think this is how feminism is maybe kidnapped or misused or appropriated. But also related to that is that often women participate. And this is something Sarah Ferris has called femo-nationalism, women who rather defend a nationalist stance than fighting for more women's rights. Like Alice Weidel, for example, often makes this argument in Germany, but also women in the US and other parts. In order to protect their rights, we need to be against immigration and vote for those right-wing parties. And this serves often another function that, of course, it's also maybe a relief not to have to fight the feminist struggle and for your emancipation. Gabi Dietze has called this an emancipation fatigue. And that's maybe something we academic feminists or gender studies scholars are sometimes a bit unaware of or don't pay enough attention to, that for many women, the struggle is very hard. It's hard for everyone. But if you don't have a well-paid job, this pressure to have it all, that it relieves you from that, for example, or from questioning the relationships that are typical for your social surroundings, where men maybe are more similar to a Donald Trump than to a well-educated Barack Obama or whatever. There's many ways in which feminism is co-opted, I would say, yes.
To bring in another thing which could be linked to anti-genderism or anti-feminism, I would say is capitalism. Would you agree? And would you say anti-genderism and capitalism is related?
Yes, absolutely. I think that capitalism is, of course, the matrix or the background against which all this plays out. Of course, it's not the sole sort of reason, but I think if we look through a lens, what that capitalism is one of the most structuring systems of our economy, but everything related to that, and probably Birgit can say much more about this than I can. Of course, and I think what I meant with the struggle over hegemony, this is exactly this moment we are currently in of neoliberal precarization and economization and individualization of all life spheres. So self-responsibilization, everyone is responsible for their own well-being and security. So people feel more insecure, particularly in states where we did have good welfare systems. And this is where the right-wingers come in, because they promise either a better past or the family as a safe haven, also against these neoliberal, globalized capital dangers that for many people causes fears and insecurity.
Julia, I fully agree what you said. And because if we take historical perspective, we can see that, well, I usually start in the 19th century, although, of course, these developments started much earlier. But you can see that in the 19th century, so the capitalist system, the patriarchal system, the imperial and colonial system developed or co-constituted themselves. So we have a patriarchal, capitalist, imperialist setting in the 20th century. And this setting, especially the patriarchal, capitalist setting, is characterized by a gender division of labor and by privatizing of the social reproduction in the notion of a family with a male breadwinner. So this has been the model, and also the welfare state which tried to tame the capitalist way of production. Even these welfare states included this gender or women's discriminative structure, this patriarchal structure. So there have always been struggles of the women's movement since the 19th century to overcome these structures. And then since the 1970s, we can see, well, on the one hand, the women's movement was successful, and on the other hand, capitalist accumulation went to different forms of regulation. These new forms of regulation meant, for instance, including women rather slowly, but nevertheless, into the labor force. And this was accelerated by the neoliberal restructuring of society since the late 1980s, where women somehow were pushed into the labor market, although in a rather precarious way, still somehow being dependent on a male breadwinner. But there has been a lot of restructuring in this capitalist organizing of society. And of course, this comes along with a lot of precarization, with a lot of insecurity for men and for women alike, I would say. However, we can see that the right wingers try to interpret these changes as a loss of masculinity. So this is what I meant before. They blame women for being successful on the labor market, for being more publicly visible, and for taking away opportunities from men. So they describe these changes in the capitalist economy and in the organization of society as a loss for men, and only as a loss for men, yeah? And that's why they proclaim this crisis of masculinity, and that they have to, that men have to regain their masculinity, and of course that these right-wing parties will support men in reclaiming their, and it's often a rather aggressive masculinity. And we can see that this narrative of a crisis of masculinity is not at all new. We had that at the end of the 19th century, and there it more obviously than today came with anti-Semitic narrations, because then the Jews were seen as feminizing the society. Now today, we can see, well, differently in different countries, there are still these anti-Semitic arguments, but not that openly. So the right-wingers somehow learned. But if we look at the right-wing extremists, assassins over the last year, the murderers in different countries across the globe, they all use this notion of a feminization of culture, which is damaging societies, and of this crisis of masculinity.
Maybe that this might partly explain why sometimes interestingly or strangely or paradoxically right-wingers pursue anti-capitalist arguments, like Donald Trump, for instance, with nationalizing parts of the economy, which some earlier left-wingers would have signed up for. But this sort of, I think, ties in with what Birgit just described, these developments.
Yeah. So, Birgit, would you say that a critique of capitalism is indispensable for intersectional feminism?
Well, the notion of intersectionality means that we have to take into account different structures of domination. And of course, I would say capitalism and class domination, gender and patriarchy, racism are dominant structures of domination that have to be taken into account. And I like the notion of intersectionality because it's very complex, so it's very difficult to think it. But I think it's not a good political strategy to say, well, capitalism is the dominant structure of domination. But I think we have to reinvent this, what others call class struggle. And this is what the feminist movement and gender studies, in my perspective, has always tried to do, to say, well, there is this intersection of different forms of domination, and we have to deconstruct these intersections. We have to find out how these dominations work into each other. And so still now today, I think it's important to really point out that we have these different forms of oppression or of domination. And it's the only way to an emancipatory politics to look at all these strands of discrimination.
Because we talked a lot about the political structure here, but you both mentioned as well that there is a huge agreement in the society, of course. I want to talk about this as one of the last points. Julia, do you see this as a major problem, that there are networking groups of right-wing groups or anti-equality movements, and maybe that there are also a networking international?
I absolutely do think so, and that's part of or of what we've been describing. For example, religious actors increasingly form transnational alliances together with conservative to extremist politicians. For example, many evangelical organizations like the Divorce Center in the US, for example, they organize like congresses that are often labeled something like for the family or the favor of family or something like this, tying in also with the discourse of so-called concerned parents, and build networks. And what is sort of troublesome is that they manage to unite very diverse actors that otherwise would not form alliances. And here, I think the function of gender is particularly interesting. I think Andrea Pieteux has probably mentioned that it serves as a symbolic glue. I would add it's an arena and a meta language to sort of also sort of negotiate these issues of power to define, definition, authority, hegemony, and so on in this case. And that's indeed a danger. There are also organizations such as Citizen Go, I think founded in Spain, that pursue a similar aim, Hazte Oír. That's also spreading a lot in Latin America, for example. So I really do see this as a danger also, because also I think they are influencing discourses. And then you have local movements, pro-life, pro-family. Yeah. That's often the discourse, which doesn't sound necessarily right-wing or anti-gender to begin with, but sort of shifts this discourse. And that's interesting. And gender also, I think, serves as an effective bridge, as Gabi Dietze had it, and Birgit is also an expert on elaborating on the effective governmentality related to the phenomena, because gender is something where most people relate to in a very emotional way. So a perfect tool for effective coalition building and so on. And I think this plays in here also. And also the strategy of this reverse colonialism, that now the conservatives and religious groups are attacked by feminists and gender studies representatives and LGBTQI activists and so on and so forth. And I think this is clearly related to this struggle over hegemony, which is partly caused, of course, also by the successes of emancipatory movements.
Yeah, so we see a huge positive framing in all these words like pro-life, as you mentioned, right? Yeah, would you agree with that, Birgit, what Julia said?
Yeah, I would agree, because we can see, without being a conspiracy theorist, we can see that there is a lot of networking going on across the world. As Julia already mentioned, this World Congress on Families, it's really an international anti-abortion organization funded in Russia with the support of groups within the US. And there is a lot of money behind it. Yeah, they are funded by churches. They are partly funded by governments. So there is really a lot of money. And they organize across the globe. And this World Conference on Families invited, for instance, Birgit Kelle, so the German anti-gender activists. And there you can see that there are existing international networks. And of course, also Julia mentioned new social media.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They organize on the new social media, and the Citizen Go is a platform which organizes campaigns on the internet against gender. And they were rather successful, for instance, organizing a huge campaign against the European Parliament report on abortion, which was meant to grant reproductive rights across Europe. And the same happened with the so-called Lunacek report by the European Parliament, by the Austrian member of European Parliament, Ulrike Lunacek, on the situation of homosexuals in Europe. So there were two reports targeting the issue of sexuality and gender in the European Parliament, and the Citizen Go platform organized, I don't know how many signatures against these reports, and so that they were not passed in Parliament. I think at the end they have been passed and recognized by the European Parliament, but it's just an example to see the huge amount of power which is behind these networks and organizations, and that they are organizing transnational via social media.
I mean, one thing is that you find conservatives or fundamentalists of all faiths often in there, also like Muslims, for example, or Jewish representatives. But mentioning the social media, there's also the manosphere and sort of men's rights groups organizing online, but many who unite under the banner of outright hate towards feminism, but often is overseen. Maybe that many of the terrorist attackers recently were influenced by these groups, like already Breivik in Norway, but also in Halle last year and Hanau. This is also a danger I see that's often underestimated in relation to the racism that they also sort of course, bring in. But I think here a gender lens would be especially helpful. And I think also authorities are starting to use it in order to see how influential this fear is also.
Because you opened up a bit to that already. And as something to close this round, I want to end with a bit more positive, I hope. So to both of you, the question, and then you can answer after each other. Is there something that can be done against this anti-gender movements? And if so, what?
Yeah, well, as an intersectional theorist, I would say, well, there is an intersectional strategy needed, meaning that rather different social movements, different equality organization have to create alliances against this right-wing opposition to gender and to gender equality. And what we have been seeing is that, for instance, the women's marches, organized also on a global scale, try to organize as an intersectional movement. So these were not only women, but these were all genders within these demonstrations. It were not only feminist movements, but a lot of equality movements in the US, but also in Europe. So I think this would be a perspective to build alliances between rather different, somehow competing social movements. I would also say that the alliance is needed with the old social equality organizations, meaning the trade unions, because they are also attacked by the right wingers. So, and if the trade unions would jump into a feminist and anti-racist movement, I think this would create a momentum where the trade unions could win, but where also we can see that there might be a push against the right. Because what we could see is that social democrats lose. Also, of course, trade unions lost a lot of members. But I would say if they want to somehow revive this, they have to organize with other social movements on a national level, but of course also on an international level. And I would say, well, we can see there is a movement within the European Parliament and the right-wing parties there. But I think it would also be rather helpful if the social movements on the European level just like the European Women's Lobby or the European Trade Union Organization or the Organization of Homosexuals on a European level would also unite with those within the European Parliament opposing the right-wing parties.
Yes, I absolutely agree on the necessity of intersectional coalitions. And I think, as Birgit already also mentioned, that many of the current feminist movements that we see, or intersectional feminist movements, I would include Black Lives Matter, also and not coincidentally formed when this right-wing trend sort of gained force. And I think they are already trying to practice embodied intersectionality by bringing bodies to the street. Most of them are also not only organizing online, and many are related to grassroots organizations and really try to bring people also into power. I know that the Women's March, I have done little research on in the US, has really tried that, to bring women of minority groups and other minority representatives into political positions, and also attack the structures of oppression in their entangled or intersectional way, right? And we see that also in Latin American movements like Ni Una Menos that address the colonial structures that also organize gender and racial relations, but also capitalism in their context, but also globally. So I think there's a lot of potential and more need for coalitions in very practical fields, as Birgit mentioned. And on an analytical level also, to understand the complexity, intersectionality is indispensable. And also to, of course, not give into this discourse, which is really threatening, to sort of continue to stand up for the other side, for plurality, for open societies and all that. Also to stick to feminist and gender studies positions, anti-racist positions and so on and so forth, or even more than ever.
Yeah, thank you both for discussing with me today, Professor Julia Roth and Professor Birgit Sauer, about right-wing populism and anti-gender ideologies. If you listeners are more interested in the research of them both or the research group at CIF as well, you can find the web link in our show notes below the podcast episode. This was today's episode of Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights. My name is Katharina Usling. I say thank you for listening and goodbye until the next episode.